Good morning. We're having a little technical difficulties here in the WPVC studio this morning. I'm not really sure if you're hearing me out there. My kind of sound engineer is looking at me like, you know, maybe I've grown an extra head or I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, welcome to Charlottesville. Welcome to Radio on a Shoestring. We're just gonna try to begin this interview. Olivia, let me suggest you step out in the hallway and see if we're on the air.
Fashioned way.
That's right. We're very professional here. By the way, the makeup artist did a great job with you.
Thanks.
Today's show is Dahlia Lithwick, legal and courts reporter for Slate Magazine. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
I am so happy to have you, and I wish it had been a little smoother at the outset here, but but on we go. So talk to me a little bit about the main reason that you're here, other than you're just fabulous and I love you and I want to hear everything you have to say, is because Scalia died. and so I want to hear what you have to say about what happens now. There's this vacancy and there's this advice and consent problem with the Senate and what's going on.
It's so crazy because if you know, first of all, one of the reasons I choose to be a Supreme Court reporter is because your life is perfectly predictable. And like mid-March, April, we're supposed to be really quiet.
Right.
They're not, right? I've been on planes for the last month because this has just been high drama and nobody thought it was coming. You know, it's true. Scalia was really old. He had a bottle of wine and a cigar every day. We should have probably, instead of worrying about Ruth Bader Ginsburg all these years, we should have been like, huh, is he going to live forever? But I just think he had such an outsized personality and outsized influence on the court that people just thought he'd be around for another
30 years. We just assumed, you know, that he was going to make it forever.
Forever.
He was just too ornery to die.
And exactly. And so this has just been, I can't even describe how weird it is even to physically be at the Supreme Court. And up until this week, you know, his chair was draped in black. His absence was almost more keenly felt than his presence. You know, it was really that profound losing him. And
right.
It's shifted, I mean, in all sorts of interesting ways, and we'll talk about the confirmation in a minute, but it's just shifted the energy at the court so that for the first time in my career, instead of sort of having five Republican, you know, from the playbook, you know, conservative Federalist Society people, it's four. And there's four progressives on the court, or liberal center progressives, and it just, the whole thing feels different. So just arguments feel different.
It's going to create a real problem for us this term in terms of making decisions, is it not?
It is, and I think that the thing that sort of was under the radar, in addition to this being an election year and having, you know, at the time when the term started, you know, we had one 82-year-old, we had three justices who were going to be time of elections or almost 80. This is not a young court, so
right.
The court was going to be on the menu in
right.
November anyway. But in addition to that, we also have what I think would have been the term of the century. You know, we all kind of weren't watching because Obergefell was such a big deal last year. But this term, the court took on affirmative action in higher education. The court took on one person, one vote, and whether we could change that to one voter, one vote. The court took on the financing of public sector unions that would have pretty much eviscerated the funding for public sector unions around the country. And the court took on, finally, after decades, the biggest abortion case that they were going to look at since Casey. And the court took on this huge Hobby Lobby 2.0, Zubik, which we heard
right.
this year. You know, and Obama's immigration reform. All that was on the court's
docket.
That's
a pretty full plate.
It was huge.
The Supreme Court buffet.
And I think some of these cases that I'm describing were really, you know, in the same way that King versus Burwell, last year's Affordable Care Act case, these were cases that were on the docket because conservative groups were very, very careful to get these cases. Some of them were, you know, this unions case. Justice Alito basically asked for this case. You know, one person won.
Bring it
vote.
On. Why? Because we have the votes.
Because we have
we'll
five.
Nail it down now.
So this
sure.
was this term would have been a sea change.
And then suddenly they don't.
Exactly. And so I think it's just really now part of what I think you're seeing in the, and this was your question that you asked me 10 minutes ago, but like, I think that part of what we're seeing with the refusal to even hear, have a hearing for Merrick Garland, to even think about seating somebody, is that losing that five certain votes, even with Kennedy, five certain votes, and seeing the court shift possibly for decades, I mean, this could not be higher stakes poker. And I think you really need to look at what was on the docket to understand what was kind of imperiled going into this term.
I understand. Well, you rattled off a number of cases there and a number of items, sort of a brief summary, a phrase summary of each. but why don't you take us through those cases in a little more detail? Just kind of start with the biggest and hairiest, and, you know, give us the name of the case.
Sure.
And, you know, a brief summary of the facts, counselor,
I happen to have brought my notebook.
Look there.
You know, this was, we were going to, whatever else happened, we were going to decide abortion this term. And so 2 weeks ago, the court heard Whole Woman's Health. This is this huge monster case out of Texas. This was HB2. You may remember from the famous Wendy Davis filibuster.
Oh, this is the one with the pink tennis shoes.
Yes.
The woman gets up, the legislator gets up, and she's wearing her pink running shoes.
Right.
And she does a big filibuster, and so everybody started buying pink tennis shoes.
Exactly. And this was, I mean, this was one of the, this was Texas passed this omnibus abortion restrictions.
Right.
And it would have had the effect of, it already had the effect, there are 40 clinics in
right.
Texas. It's already shuttered 20
is this
of them.
Is this one of those rules that says, you know, you must have a hospital and your hallways must be X inches wide and, you know,
yes.
all that kind of ridiculousness?
Yes. There are two provisions that are at issue before the court, and these are sort of called trap laws, right?
Mm-hmm.
These are the targeted restrictions of abortion providers, and we see them all over the country, including here in Virginia, where you pass laws that are sort of purportedly for women's health, but the effect is to shut down clinics.
This is like passing a literacy test law to stop the African Americans from voting.
It looks
right?
like a poll tax.
Right.
And the two issues, so you've nailed one of them. One of them is the idea that every single clinic that provides abortions in Texas has to be retrofitted as a so-called ambulatory surgical center. So even though most abortions are not surgical, right? Most abortions are medical. You have to have like a huge surgical suite. You have to have like an HVAC system. The broom closets have to be a certain size.
All right, wait.
Yeah, yeah.
You just said something. You said most abortions are not surgical. Most abortions are medical.
Right.
Flesh that out for me.
That's just the pills. I mean, many, you know.
You're talking about morning after pills.
Right.
So you're talking about for these clinics to even dispense that kind of medication, they have to be a surgical ambulatory
right.
center.
Right. And it's really important to, if you go back and look, and I would commend to listeners who want to sort of think about this, a brand new film that's just come out called Trapped, and it plays mm-hmm. on that trap laws. But, you know, it shows what these clinics have had to do to retrofit themselves. Literally, they have to have corridors wide enough for two gurneys to pass in the hallway, even though not even one gurney is needed
in
these
procedures.
It's
never going to go down that hallway.
These are not surgeries, right? There is no possibility of infection from even a surgical abortion. And so the idea was, you know, we're going to, even though the abortion mortality rates and complexities are so low, much lower than, you know, liposuction,
right.
much lower than some dental surgery. Only abortion clinics are, you know, singled out in Texas, and we have these all over the country. The other law at issue in Texas was the providers had to get admitting privileges mm-hmm. at hospitals, which are within
right.
30 miles. Why is this a problem? It seems reasonable because hospitals won't give them admitting privileges, particularly religious hospitals.
Because lots of the hospitals are run by the churches. And so therefore, on that sort of moral ground, they decline to give someone privileges.
They decline to give privileges. And the other piece of this that's really important is that we have laws on the book, federal laws, that say that if you are brought to a hospital following complications from an abortion, you must be admitted.
Right.
So you don't need your doctor to have admitting privileges. It's a nice perk,
right.
I suppose, but it is no way going to save a life. So those are the two issues that come before the court, and it's important to understand, you know, how many hundreds of similar restrictions around the country
and
have
the
been
passed. And the name of this case again is?
This case is Whole Women's Health versus Zubik, and it comes to the court, the doctrinal underpinning of this, and it's complicated, is that in Roe v. Wade, the court had that trimester system, right?
Mm-hmm.
They said
right.
you can do certain things in the first trimester when the fetus becomes viable, less and less regulation. That gets gutted in Casey, right? In 1992, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, everybody expects the court just to eviscerate Roe. Mm-hmm. And there's a surprise trifecta. In Casey, it's Justice David Souter, Sandra Day O'Connor, and surprisingly, Anthony Kennedy get together to save the core idea of Roe, save the idea that we have a constitutional right to abortion. But they create this really squishy, only in Sandra Day O'Connor's brain test. And it's called the undue burden test. And what basically what they say is that nobody knows what this means except Sandra Day O'Connor.
Right.
But you cannot place an undue burden. The state cannot. It has an interest in protecting fetal life and the health of the mother. No undue burden. So really, we've spent the intervening years since Casey, courts trying to figure out what that meant.
We punted in order to not really have to do anything with this yet.
Right.
And now the conservatives have lined it up for the right-wing justices to sort of bat it out of the park, and then they lost their major batter.
Right. And the important thing to understand about this case is it's one of two monster reproductive rights cases. We'll talk about the other in a second. But there was no doubt, I think, that Justice Kennedy was going to refine this undue burden test, mm-hmm. right? So in Texas, we have women who have to drive 300 miles. I had started to say we went from 40 clinics in Texas to 20. If this law is allowed to go into effect, there will be 10 for the entire state of Texas. There are going
Texas
to be-
is large, as I recall.
Yes.
It's big.
Millions of women of reproductive age. Some, you know, the entire Rio Grande Valley has no clinics. And so this case would have said, you know, you want an abortion, you come to our clinic, you drive 300 miles, get a hotel room, you have to take this pill, you have to drive home for 300 miles, you have to come back the next day and take another. Those are the kinds of restrictions.
And of course, the people who are most impacted by this, aside from being women, are poor women.
Well,
because if you are affluent, you live in an area with more hospitals and you're not driving 300 miles.
And you know, how do you get childcare? How do you get those 2 days off work? And when the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals reviewed these two laws, the ambulatory surgical centers and the admitting privileges law, they more or less said, you know, Texas on the flat roads, you can drive, you know, good, you know, 80 miles an hour. This is no burden. And they really said this is not an undue burden. And the question for the court, the sort of constitutional doctrinal question is, if this isn't an undue burden on the right to choose, what is? So that was argued a few weeks ago. And just as a coda to that, I would say, having sat in that argument, this was just a moment where Sandra Day O'Connor is gone, but you have Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Elena Kagan, and Sonia Sotomayor pounding the living snot out of the Solicitor General for Texas, just saying, how is this possibly related to protecting women's health? You are endangering women. And Justice Breyer, I have to give him props, was right there saying, I'm sorry, I've looked at the record. I have found one case in the entire country, not in Texas, of one person maybe needing to be admitted to a hospital. Really? Seriously?
Right.
And
right.
It was quite a festival of just poking at this idea that this is a total pretext.
So now that Scalia is gone and not deciding this, what's going to happen with cases like that? I mean, we got 4-4, yes?
Well, I think so, although it could be, it's entirely possible that Justice Kennedy, I mean, he certainly made noises in that case.
And we are very fond of him after some recent decisions in the gay community.
Yes, I mean, he's funny, but you know, this goes to something I think is really important. Justice Kennedy, some minorities and classes of people are really visible to him. Some are not. And, you know, I wasn't surprised by Obergefell. Maybe you were, but you know, if you read him in Romer, if you read him in Lawrence versus Texas, right, the sodomy case out of Texas, this is a man who always connects the word dignity to LGBT.
I wasn't
questions.
Surprised. I was just terrified.
No, it was terrifying. But I think he just accords such dignity, particularly, you know, to the kinds of gay couples that are married and have children, and you know, of course they. Why he doesn't afford that dignity to women is a really interesting question to me. And if you think about Justice Kennedy in the abortion context, you know, take him out of the same-sex marriage context and think about, you know, the last major opinion he wrote about abortion was in the partial birth abortion case in 2007. And you may remember he voted with the court's conservatives to uphold the federal birth abortion ban, and literally wrote this paragraph about how women come to regret this decision. You know, they need to be helped to make better choices because, and then he, you know,
well, they
cited,
need daddy.
Yeah, I mean, he cited the suicide data, all the stuff that has been roundly debunked by everyone in the medical academy. And this exactly, daddy, this paternalistic, you know, we need to help women just make better choices. And that's why I went into Whole Women's Health. Olivia's like,
like it's her face. There's a lot of head shaking going
on. No, I mean, it's, you know, you read Ruth Bader Ginsburg dissenting in that case, and she's like, what? Like, you do not need to tell me and other women about how to make better choices. And so you worry when you go into these reproductive rights cases, because I think, like, the minority woman in Texas who has to find childcare and, you know, drive 200 miles to find a doctor and then go home and then go back, she's not visible to him at all.
Hmm. Wow.
So that's depressing.
Well, so let's talk about what's going to happen in that case. So that case has been heard with an 8-justice court.
Right.
And obviously, if Kennedy sides with the liberals, then that case will get decided and all will be ducky.
Right.
If he doesn't, the Fifth Circuit opinion holds, right?
So this is probably the most important thing. If you're going to talk about filling the Scalia vacancy, it's important to understand what's going to happen to this litany of cases we've talked about. Mm-hmm. Anything that comes down 4-4, the court issues what's called a per curiam. They just have an unsigned opinion saying we're 4-4. There's no opinion.
Right.
That means that in the jurisdiction that decided that case, the lower court, the appeals court's decision holds.
Right.
But other jurisdictions, it's not the law.
Right.
So what you're going to have is, let's say they uphold the restrictions, which I don't think they will. Well, that means in the Fifth Circuit, it's constitutional to have admitting privileges.
But if you drive over into the next circuit, maybe not.
Sorry, in New Mexico, things are different.
Which was the whole problem that gay couples were facing.
Sure.
Earlier.
And it's why we have...
In terms of, you know, you get on the metro and, you know, you arrive at this stop and you're married and you arrive at that one and you just got divorced.
And you're not. And this is why we have a Supreme Court, right? I mean, I think the most pointed statement of why we can't have 4-4 decisions comes from Antonin Scalia, who you may remember when he was hunting with Dick Cheney and was asked to recuse himself, right, in the case that was like, wait, you were in a, like, duck blind with him 3 months ago, and now you're deciding the case. And he wrote this, like, amazing memorandum that was like a, here's my explanation to the American public why I will not recuse myself. Mm-hmm. And one of the most pointed things he said is that a 4-4 court can't function.
Right.
And I'm not going to recuse every time someone calls on to me to recuse. And you can question the wisdom of that or not. But I think the point is you are going to, after Whole Women's Health, after Zubik, after Fisher, you know, all these cases we're talking about, if you have a checkerboard of laws in this country where it's constitutional to do something in Texas, but it's not in California. That's why we have a Supreme Court.
It's untenable, but it won't last. I mean, right? Because ultimately we will have another justice on that court and these cases will get decided. But I wonder what the timeline will be. I mean, it takes a long time for something to work its way up there. So this checkerboard might last for 3 to 5 years.
Well, I think what's important, and this is, you know, the other issue that people need to sort of sit with, is that historically, we've had 4-4 courts before. We had a 4-4 court, you know, not very long ago when we were replacing Sam Alito taking Sandra Day O'Connor's seat. So there are time periods when you can have 8. But the court has always either held it over, right? And this happens often. We're going to wait. We're going to sit on this. We're going to hear it next October when we're sitting again. Mm-hmm. Or you find some tiny jurisdictional, you know, we'll kick it back to Texas and we'll look at it again next year. We can't do that for the foreseeable next 3 years, like you say, we don't have 9 justices. So there are tricks that the court can invoke.
Wait. We're not going to not have 9 justices for 3 years.
Well, you know, so this the most interesting thing to me. And there's so many things that are interesting.
Tell me we're not going to have 9 justices.
I don't know what to tell you. The most interesting thing was not that within an hour of Justice Scalia's death, we were hearing Mitch McConnell and Ted Cruz say, we're not having no hearings. We don't even have a name yet.
And we don't care who it is. We're not hearing it. Right.
That was interesting. And certainly when Merrick Garland gets named last week, you know, certainly interesting, right? We're not even going to meet with him. We're going to hide under our desks in the Capitol when he comes by for his courtesy meetings because, if you give a judge a meeting, he's going to want a cookie. And so that, all of that, sort of shocking and unprecedented, and I think we can stipulate this has never happened. We can talk about the Biden rule, but it has never happened that a judge hasn't had a meeting. But the more interesting thing happened last weekend on the Sunday shows, where Mitch McConnell, I think, did one of those great Freudian gaffes and said, oh, no, even after November, we couldn't have a hearing for Merrick Garland because the NRA would never allow us to confirm someone like that. And I think he probably, the NRA probably speed dialed him and said, we don't say that out loud in America. It's like just something you think in your head, but you can't really say. But I do think that the idea that this is not advice and consent of the United States Senate.
Right.
This is the advice and consent of the NRA. And remember, we started at the beginning of this conversation saying this is so consequential to lose this seat that it starts to look as though no matter who is put up, if a Democrat wins the election, there can't be a hearing because we can't lose this seat.
So if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Straight Talk with Andre Hakes, and my guest today is Dahlia Lithwick, who's a courts and Supreme Court reporter for Slate Magazine, among other magnificent qualifications, to be chatting with us this morning. So we were just, you know, we've sort of covered the women's health case, and we've talked a little bit about, you know, how long could this checkerboard go on? How long could we be stuck here? Don't you think if we get a Democratic president, I mean, if the Republicans end up running Trump, they're going to lose the Senate too, don't you think?
So the best column, you know, how often do you say the words, I totally agree with George Will?
Never.
Well, okay, so you need to go back and read the column he wrote last Sunday saying this is just a stupid, stupid strategy. Mm-hmm. Because, A, we're going to lose the Senate, right? We already have seen Mark Kirk, Susan Collins. You know, there's been a huge fissure, that sort of wall of obstruction mm-hmm. on the GOP side saying we're not going to even have a hearing is already, we've got
three
senators who
mm-hmm.
are saying this is not, I can't get reelected
being if we do this. Right.
And we've got the polling to suggest that even among independents and Republicans, this obstruction is kind of a bridge too far.
Right.
But George Will sort of doubles down and says, I don't think he said it in these words, but this was the implication. What are we going to do when Trump wins and, like, Justice Sarah Palin is seated? Like, that's not good. For the Federalist Society. No, he didn't name Sarah Palin. I'm doing that. I think it will be Justice Ivanka or possibly Justice Miss Tennessee. But I think that
I'm spitballing.
But I just think, like, Will's point is we need to really be smart about, you know, Merrick Garland is, and we should talk about Garland, but, you know, he's as good as it's going to get for the right in the foreseeable future. And if Trump wins, we're going to get a nut job. And so that does not, you know, redound to our benefit. And so it seems to me that a little bit of, you know, the issue that you're sort of asking about is, you know, how does this play out going into the future?
Right.
And I think, you know, one question, and I've been asked this a lot, and I have tried to report it out, I don't have an answer, is if Hillary wins in the general, does Merrick Garland get withdrawn? Does he withdraw himself? Does Hillary have an opportunity to sit, you know, see a Thurgood Marshall? And I don't think that's the play here. I don't get the sense that that's what Obama wants. I don't get the sense that that's what Hillary wants. Let's recall we have three justices who are, you know, going to be 80 or 80. So assuming that Hillary Clinton wins the election, I think she's still going to get to fill some seats.
It sounds like the play is they really want to get this person nominated. I mean, that's what it sounds like to me. Of course, I'm, you know, down here in Charlottesville talking to you on this little local radio station can't get its on the air broadcast, right?
I think that's the play. I think that, you know, and we should talk about this because it's, I think progressives have been as angry as conservatives. I think progressives wanted Obama to do a sort of screw you nominee that would rally the base. You know, he had an opportunity to make a historic pick, and he picks the 62-year-old white guy from Harvard.
Well, we did just kind of watch this happen in Virginia, right? I mean, did you remember the Virginia Supreme Court
yes,
Cuccinelli nomination?
The Cuccinelli, you know.
God, we all held our breath for, you know, 24 hours.
But maybe that's the way to think about this, is that was the most shockingly agree. I mean, Cuccinelli didn't mm-hmm. see that coming, right? That was this egregious way to say you want to see your person on the court.
Tough? Let's
we'll
play.
Get the craziest person in town and scare you. And I think Obama could have done that.
Right.
I think Obama certainly could have put up, and if you look at the shortlist that was circulating in the last couple of days, you know, it was Loretta Lynch, it was Sri Srinivasan, you know, it was Paul Watford from the Ninth Circuit. You know, these are powerhouse African Americans that would have absolutely, I think, rallied the base. People would have been excited. You know, what, we're going to get the third African American on the court. That was exciting. He chose not to do that.
Did we not do it because we think we might actually get Merrick through?
So I have two, again, I've tried to report this and have had, you know, the much of the reporting I'm hearing back is that this is what Obama wanted. He wanted to play it completely up the middle. He wanted to change the conversation from a political, ideological conversation to a conversation about the court. And I think what he really wanted to say is, I'm going to put up a judge's judge, right? Merrick Garland, like him or hate him, and I think everybody is frustrated because he doesn't enthuse anyone except maybe Mrs. Merrick Garland and the two Garland daughters. Nobody is really fired up.
Right.
But I think it was a choice to say, this is a guy with 19 years experience on the federal bench. This is a guy with a right down the middle record. This is a person who has absolutely in every case, political and partisan case before him, chosen the narrowest, least political reading of the law. This is a way to say the court is different.
This is a guy who's done what judges are supposed to do.
Well, that's kind of, thank you for saying that, because I think that an awful lot of people, and this is important too, I think this is really maybe the key for me. Obama has been telling us, like it or not, that he would never seat a Thurgood Marshall. He would never seat a Bill Brennan. He has had the choice. He had the Senate, and he could have seated, right, a liberal Scalia if he wanted to. And he put up a sort of center-left Sotomayor. He put up a center left-ish Elena Kagan. And he said, you know, he gave this interview to the Cleveland Plain Dealer at the beginning of his presidency, where he said, listen, nobody admires Thurgood Marshall and Brennan more than I do, and their time is done on the court. Elections matter. Politics matters. The court is a check. The court does not drive policy. And I think everybody didn't believe him.
Right.
I think we're all like, yeah, but given the choice, he's going to put up, you know, the most rabid liberal version of Scalia because he's got a, you know, a chance to do that.
But
and
no,
he
in fact,
didn't.
Perhaps he's behaving in a more mature manner than we want him to.
Well, I think there's something there. I think that there is a quality in him, and it's the quality that drives progressives insane. That is, he really believes in process. He believes in compromise. He believes absolutely in reaching across the aisle and trying to find a middle space. And we're all like, Obama, guess how well that worked out for you for the last 8 years? Like, that has not been a good strategy, but that's exactly the nominee he picked.
In a way, it's the right thing. Might not be a good strategy, but it's the right thing.
Yeah. I wish I could convey to listeners the face that I'm seeing here. It's like, wah, wah. Like, it's the right thing. Like, nobody feels good.
Nobody likes it.
About the right thing. And it's funny because, you know, I absolutely, you know, a week before he picked Garland, I wrote a piece that said, he's not going to get this person cleared. So just pick Elizabeth Warren.
Right.
Like, pick somebody who's exciting. You know, pick somebody who everybody could get really excited about. And I just think that's not his way. And there's a deep sense with a week to think about it that he is trying to be a grown-up. He did try to pick a grown-up. He tried to say this game we've gotten into where we pick nominees who are 42 and like raised in a lab to never have an opinion.
Right.
That has to stop. And so he picked someone who, you know, we know what we're getting, and he picked a grown up, and this person is not going to be on the court for 50 years. And, you know, you can like it or not, but I think you have to respect the intention, which was a completely apolitical intention.
Yeah.
I
do kind of respect that. That's the funny thing, is that I really appreciate someone who is trying in good faith to do the right thing. But I, at the same time, you know, we all act strategically. It's what we do. We as lawyers, we as voters, you know, there are choices you make as a voter where you look at candidates and you go, well, I like that one better, but they're not going to win.
Exactly.
So it's not how I'm going to vote.
Exactly. And I think, you know, in the intervening week, if you think about the candidates trash talking each other's wives and threatening to carpet bomb and torture and waterboard, I think being an adult in this moment in history might not be, you know, a horrific choice. I mean, the more Obama plays this absolutely, you know, as an adult, the more you go, you know, this is in contrast to Ted Cruz, who says literally on the stump that the single worst nominee in history of in his lifetime is John Roberts. Because John Roberts, he says, betrayed, you know, the right on the two health care cases.
Right.
And you're like, I'm sorry, what?
Right.
What?
Right.
You know, John Roberts is a pot-smoking hippie liberal? Like, under no set of facts
right.
is that accurate. But I just think it goes to, and maybe that loops back to the sort of NRA thing, that ideology has come to so dominate the conversation about the Supreme Court that if Roberts isn't conservative enough for Ted Cruz.
Right.
Who is?
Everything has become so polarized mm-hmm. that it is a greater sin to do something that doesn't benefit your team than it is to make a decision that maybe doesn't benefit your conscience.
And maybe, you know, maybe this is a good way in. If we have a second, it's a good way in to talk about the other women's reproductive case that happened this week, because this was the religious one.
Hold that thought. We're going to take a brief break and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Straight Talk on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. If you'd like to participate in the program, it's 434-284-9470. And now, back to your host, Andre Hakes.
So we are back on the air, and Dahlia, you were just about to say something about the other reproductive rights case going on.
Well, I think it's a useful kind of comparator, because I just talked about, you know, the abortion case that was argued at the beginning of March, and the other monster case is Hobby Lobby 2.0, argued this Wednesday at the court. And I think it dovetails nicely with what you were saying about, you know, sort of ideology all the way down. And this case, you know, if folks remember Hobby Lobby from 2014, this was a case in which, you know, the Obama Affordable Care Act had a comprehensive package of preventative care, and it includes contraception,
birth control.
Birth control and things that are abortifacients.
Hobby Lobby thought it was evil.
And so Hobby Lobby said these are abortifacients, these devices,
right?
And they name devices, and medical science does not support the fact that they cause abortions, but Hobby Lobby said we cannot give them to our employees, whether they're our faith or not.
Right.
We cannot afford those devices, and they come to the court, and the court does two astonishing things in Hobby Lobby. One is it finds that these for-profit corporations are people.
Yeah.
And they can have faith.
Hmm.
And that they can impose the, you know, burden their employees who have a statutory entitlement to these devices and products. They can burden their statutory entitlement because of their own religious freedom. Right?
We're
That's
not talking
Hobby Lobby.
About a nonprofit. We're not talking about a church organization. We're talking about a company.
Right. A for-profit, you know, quilting, you know, scrapbooking store, right? That's Hobby Lobby. So what you just said is
it's
really
a very nice kitsch, by the
nice.
Way. My mother used to like to go in there.
Who
and buy
doesn't
kitsch?
Like Hobby
kitsch.
Lobby?
I don't like Hobby
but
Lobby.
But I think if you work for Hobby Lobby and, like, you need an IUD, not even just because you're a slutty tramp, but because maybe for medical reasons you need these devices and products, and women do, and your boss
says... Or maybe
says,
you're a slutty tramp
or maybe,
for Hobby Lobby.
I don't
want to...
You
want your IUD.
Nobody wants to take it away from slutty tramps.
No, absolutely
but, you
not.
Know, I think that the point was there are really pressing medical, and that doesn't even get to the economic needs, right? Women workers in this country, you know, absolutely in order to achieve economic parity with men need to be able to control their reproductive lives. And that these were all the findings of fact that led the Obama administration to say, you know what, we're putting these devices and these things as part of comprehensive medical care. So you just said the key thing to understanding Zubik, which is the case from this year. Now we do have the religious nonprofits, right? So this is not Hobby Lobby. This is the universities. This is the charities. This is the hospitals that are run by religious entities. And they come to the court and say, okay, we object too. Now, when Hobby Lobby was decided, the U.S. Supreme Court, the five all-male justices, all Catholic, I guess we should just say it, Catholic male justices say, we're going to fine for Hobby Lobby because in this instance, there is an accommodation. The Obama administration had carved out an exemption for the contraception mandate, and they said the nonprofits, the hospitals and the charities, can just check a box.
Right.
Can just say, I object, I can't do this.
A conscientious objector status
exactly.
to providing birth control.
And this was afforded to all the nonprofits. And what the court said in Hobby Lobby is, look, there's this least restrictive alternative, right?
Right.
Give Hobby Lobby the thing that you're giving the objecting nonprofit.
Right.
And then, right, they're protected.
Give this corporation a choice as a person.
To opt out.
Right.
That's what the court said. And there's language in both Alito's majority opinion, and Kennedy wrote a concurrence that says, because you've already created a workaround, just give that to the objecting for-profits. Right. That was the holding. So many of us thought, they're saying that they like the workaround.
Right.
This case comes to the court because the Little Sisters of the Poor, who are an order, very old and well-respected order of nuns who provide care and health care for the elderly poor, they say, we don't want to check the box. The mere act of checking the box, the Obama administration, I should add, creates another exemption to the exemption. They say, if you don't want to check the box, you can just send a letter that says you object.
Whoa. What's the box say?
The box says, I cannot do this. I religiously dissent. This violates my conscience.
And what's the problem with checking the box?
Wait
for it.
What
okay.
they say is, the act of checking the box allows HHS and the administration to contract directly with your insurer. So you're out of it, right?
Uh-huh.
They are going to now have a contract with your insurer or your third party insurer, and you are not involved anymore, but your employees, not necessarily,
still get their health care.
And the answer is, by checking the box, I am triggering an abortion.
Oh,
by
I see.
By sending the letter in, I am taking the apparatus of my insurance and using it to give someone abortion. That's the objection. You with me?
Yeah. So basically, checking the box says, I don't want any part of this. But then your employees are going to get the health care anyway.
Exactly.
Right?
So that's the argument.
So now we're at the place of saying, no, I want to be able to exercise my position as an employer to stand in the way of my employees getting birth control.
Well, I would say that Paul Clement, who argued this case on behalf of the Little Sisters, would not probably frame it that way. But that is the argument. The argument is, if anything happens that I set into motion, including checking a box or sending in a letter, that burdens my religious freedom. And I should say one just wonky thing for lawyers listening. This is not a constitutional case. This comes up under RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. This is the 1993 statute that was passed that basically says your religious freedom can be burdened by the government, but only if they show a compelling interest.
Mm-hmm.
And this
mm-hmm.
is the narrowest alternative, right? So
right?
strict
okay.
scrutiny.
All right, I understand, like a strict scrutiny analysis.
Yeah. But the question for the court, this was supposed to be easy because the same court, the same five justices who said, we're okay with this workaround for Hobby Lobby.
Okay.
Now look at the workaround and they're supposed to say it's not okay.
Bad workaround.
So we all thought this was an easy case. This has to be easy.
Right.
It was argued this week.
Uh-huh.
This is not an easy case. This is not an easy case for this court. The conservative members of the court absolutely bought, and here is where Paul Clement, he was Solicitor General for the George W. Bush administration. He is as fine an attorney as I have ever seen. He got up and just said, this is Obama hijacking the insurance apparatus
right.
of these little sisters, these nuns,
uh-huh.
and using it to force them to sin or pay millions of dollars in penalties.
Wow.
He likened it to, I was like, my mouth was open. He said, this is no different from the Obama administration coming into their nursing homes, taking a room in the basement, and opening a Title X clinic and handing out contraception from their property.
Wow.
And four justices, I think Clarence Thomas didn't talk, but he agrees in these cases. And Kennedy, hook, line, and sinker used that word of hijacking. This is a hijacking. So this is not an easy case.
That's really interesting. You know, what would happen if, instead of checking the box, if you were a company that didn't feel this way, if you checked the box, and then the religious companies just wouldn't check the box that said, we'd like you to do this.
Like an opt-in rather than,
Right. Then you wouldn't be doing anything.
One of the interesting colloquies, and this was a case where, again, it's so fun to see three women on the court, where Elena Kagan sort of said to Paul Clement, is there any workaround that the administration could create? Anything, smoke signal, like what could, And the answer, Paul Clement can't really answer that because the answer is any workaround that is constructed violates
which is why she asked the question.
Their rights. And I think just this is an important case because, you know, and RFRA is a complicated topic, but I think that this changes, right? And if you're thinking about those cake baker cases, if you're thinking about Kim Davis,
the wedding cases.
If you're thinking about North Carolina, I mean, if you're thinking about any of the cases where people say, I am an objector, mm-hmm. this violates my religious principles. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. This is a ground shifting moment, right? If the court were to, pardon the pun, and I don't think you have five votes today, but if the court were to accept the proposition that anything that burdens, that really foundationally burdens my religious liberty mm-hmm. can eviscerate civil rights laws, mm-hmm. can eviscerate statutory entitlements because the burden is too great.
Well, we might as well just roll back the whole civil rights era. I mean, you know, the Bible was a major justification for slavery. Yep. Let's just hang it all up.
Well, and let's remember the people when, you know, after Brown v. Board, after the big civil rights cases that had to do with race, how many people came forward and said, oh, no, this violates my religious rights.
Right,
you know,
right.
We forget that you can use that as a sort of hook into refusing to comply with any civil rights statutes. And so this case is the canary in the coal mine for people who want to think about what the court's going to be doing in the next 10 years. It's going to be this clash between religious freedom on the one hand and assertion, sort of burgeoning assertions of what my religion prohibits,
right,
on a collision course with civil liberties.
So here's Scalia's gone. Mm-hmm. It's 4-4. What was the circuit? Which way did the circuit opinion in that case go?
So this is a completely weird case. I mean, again, I'll say it again. This looked like an easy case.
Right.
One of the reasons it looked like an easy case is because 7 appeals courts mm-hmm. said no to the Little Sisters. They said this does not burden your religious liberty.
7 appeals courts. How many appeals courts can there possibly be?
Well, you know, I mean, this went to almost every court because you had a Catholic hospital or a charity
in a various jurisdiction
who came to the court. And so 7 different courts. Uh-huh. And if people want to read, the most, I think, thoughtful piece was written by Nina Pillard on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. And her name is on all my short lists. She's an amazing, amazing judge. She thoroughly debunked the proposition that religious entities can impose their religious views to the detriment of third-party workers.
Right.
And she just said, you know, checking a box, nah, this is not burdening your religion.
Right.
7 courts did that. 1 court disagreed. The 8th Circuit mm-hmm. said, nope, this workaround violates religious liberty. And so what you're going to get...
And the 8th Circuit is where?
The 8th Circuit is like Idaho, and, you know, it's a bunch of... it's actually a big clump of states, like the number of states that will be implicated if the 8th Circuit goes one way on this and all the other courts go another way. This is going to be... I'll have to look up the exact which exact states are in it. But
Northwest?
Yeah. So,
that
so
seems odd.
Well, and this is going to be one of those funny cases where if the court splits, and I would predict based on argument Wednesday that it will split, you are going to have this accommodation blessed in most jurisdictions, but there's about 5 or 6 states where this accommodation doesn't work. And think about this for the purpose of sort of national Catholic charities, national Catholic hospitals, right? These
right,
are entities
right.
that cross state lines.
Right.
So this becomes incredibly confusing.
Which is just like the marriage issue, which is just like the civil rights laws. It's part of the common carrier problem, right? If you're
mm-hmm.
going to travel
right.
as a black person in that time period, your problem was going to be that you were going to enter an area where suddenly you couldn't get public accommodations.
Right.
And so it burdens your ability to travel in the country.
Right. And here you're the employee of a Catholic hospital that has, you know, one branch that you can't move, right? I
right.
mean, if you want your birth control. And I would say one other thing about this case, just because I think the women on the court really got this. The whole point of this birth control mandate was that women could go to their doctor and say, I have a medical problem, help me out, or, you know, I have 6 kids, I don't want another, help
right.
me out. Now, the conservatives on the court are saying, no, they just need another card. This is just like dental, or, you know, this is, why can't they just have another arrangement so that the nuns aren't providing it? Why doesn't the Obama administration just create a contraception-only plan on the
a public health care?
Well, can you imagine this Congress being like, you know what, we really would sign off on,
that.
We're closing every Planned Parenthood in the country, but let's create an only birth birth control plan. I think we could do that. And many of the justices on the right side of the court, Alito said it, Roberts said it, and Kennedy said it. They all said, why don't women just get on the exchanges and get themselves a contraception-only plan? And Sotomayor, I thought her hair was going to go on fire. She was like, that is a falsehood. It is not possible. The actual law itself doesn't provide for creating other plans to put on the plan. There is no contraception-only plan.
Right.
And the very notion in my mind that the solution to this is women should just get on those exchanges and do more shopping. They're good at that. Right? I mean, it just felt so trivializing of the women's interests in these cases. And it's not, you know, Ted Cruz likes to sort of go around and say, well, when I was in college, you could just get, you know, pay 50 cents and get a condom. Like, why is this so complicated for women? And if you're a woman and you know that its entire month's salary could go to an IUD, you know that these are serious and in many cases medically compelled devices. This isn't something, you know, just jump on a plan and buy a plan that doesn't exist.
Right.
That's not an answer.
Right. Well, you mentioned a minute ago North Carolina. And, you know, I really want to talk about North Carolina. I saw a post my friend Cynthia Netherland was posting on Facebook. That's the way I found out what was going on in North Carolina. And the post was something like, are you people on crack? So tell us what's happening in North Carolina and then tell us why they can't do that.
Okay. Well, I mean, my understanding is that there's a sort of a double whammy. I think this all happened overnight, right? This was an incredibly subversive move that
it was like a secret, you know, let's not tell anybody. Bam, all of a sudden. Yeah.
So this is literally just out of the blue. And they passed this repeal of all the non-discrimination ordinances against anti-LGBT, you know, discrimination. Mm-hmm. Unbelievable. And ostensibly, it has to do with the peril of having people go into bathrooms that are, you know, chosen based on their how they self-identify as opposed mm-hmm. to their biological. But like, and it's based on this pretextual, like, because all sorts of bad things happen in bathrooms, right? Really? I mean, that's sort of the logic of this. But I think if the question is, you know, how do they do this in the dark of the night and how does it get passed? And, you know, I don't know. I think the answer is because it's North Carolina. This is without doubt the most regressive anti-LGBTQ thing I have seen.
What did they do, Dahlia? Is it basically saying all you little localities who have passed ordinances
yes.
that protect LGBT folks, we revoke your
yes.
ability to pass those ordinances?
Yes.
So it's sort of like a retroactively imposing a Dillon's rule.
Right. And it is, like, for people who are listening and saying, wait, wasn't there a Supreme Court case that made this impossible? Yes, this is Romer, right? This is 1996.
Well, tell us about Romer. You've mentioned that a couple times in our earlier conversation before we got on the air. Let's talk about Romer.
Well, Romer was this Colorado effort, right? Colorado passes essentially the same thing. They say that cities can't that are passing anti-discrimination ordinances mm-hmm. can't do that. Mm-hmm. And the court just spanks them, right? Mm-hmm. And Justice Kennedy writes the opinion. And the upshot is you cannot pick one class of citizens mm-hmm. for second-rate treatment. And that's clearly what this is.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, and I have to confess, I have not looked carefully at what they passed in North Carolina, and I haven't read Romer today, but this looks like it's so clearly unconstitutional. It looks like it's clearly targeting a disfavored minority for, you know, protection minus,
mm-hmm.
that can't be constitutional. And I also just read somewhere it also actually violates Title IX in education, you know, which forbids discrimination where you can't punish people for using bathrooms, you know, that for the gender with which they self-identify. So I think it's illegal and unconstitutional. Sort of the more interesting thing that I'm seeing in the 2 days after is, for instance, the mayor of San Francisco just told all his city employees, you may not, for work purposes, go to North Carolina. So you're going to see the kind of blowback that you're seeing, you know, in Georgia, in other states.
You're going to boycott entire states.
Well, you know, I don't know if he can enforce, like, not letting city employees go to North Carolina. But I do think that, to me, and I guess I wonder what you think, this really just goes to this whole question of, are we going to just have red states and blue states? And in those red states, you will be, you know, you will pass these state RFRAs, right? Like we saw in Indiana last year. You are going to be free to discriminate against gay Americans because of your religious preferences. And then you're going to have blue states where that's just not permissible, and we're not even going to travel to each other? Is that where this is heading?
We have those things right now with regard to other issues. You know, different states have different gun laws. Different
sure.
states have different laws about marijuana.
Sure.
So, but something about this is different. It's because I think it goes to the identity of a person as opposed to a thing, right?
I think that's right. And I think that, you know, when you're talking, I guess this goes back to this principle of saying my religion forbids me to serve pizza to someone who's gay, right? That's
right.
What we were hearing in Indiana.
I can't cook your wedding cake.
Yeah, I can't take pictures of your wedding, you know,
right.
and it goes to your public accommodations point. And, you know, it also, some of these speeches, these cases are coming up as speech cases, you know, like
right.
this is a, I have a free speech right not
well, doesn't this all come back to Citizens United?
How?
Well, because we're
oh,
saying
because
these
corporations.
Are corporations, and corporations are people, and corporations have religion, like Hobby Lobby, and corporations have speech rights, right? Isn't that what Citizens United was about?
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's such a good point. I think one of the legacies of the Roberts Court, when we think about it, you know, as construed with Scalia still on it, will be this creeping First Amendment, you know, bubble that everything gets protected as a speech right. And I'm thinking, you know, as I'm talking to you about the abortion protest case from 2 years ago, where you remember Massachusetts had created bubbles where you couldn't
a free speech zone.
Yeah,
is that
but
something I associate with Bush.
Yeah, no, but this was the opposite. This was, you know, this was on the, in the wake of horrible clinic massacres in Massachusetts,
right.
and the state saying we can't figure out how to keep women safe
right.
walking to and from
right.
a clinic. We cannot keep them safe,
right.
and so you cannot approach them and try
right.
to evangelize them walking into a clinic.
Right.
And the court struck it down.
Right.
And this
yes,
is because of the free speech rights of
sure.
the protesters.
Sure.
And, you know,
it's different. That is a person. That is an individual who is making that speech and trying to have a conversation with someone. And that's different than I'm a company.
Yeah.
And the company says, I don't, you know, my company religion doesn't allow me to X.
No, you're right. I think there is a difference. And in that sense, you know, Hobby Lobby is the precursor to the follow on to Citizens United, because once a company has even a for-profit company has the right to speak as they do in Citizens United, sure, they should have a right to religion. Right. And I think they could also have the right to bear arms.
Are we ever going to undo Citizens United? Do you think we have a shot at it?
So one of my favorite things about Bernie Sanders is that he likes to stay on the stump, that the one thing he will do is put up a justice who on the first day on the court will overturn Citizens United, whether there's a case or not, whether there's an appeal on the docket or not. I think that's too easy.
It's a statement of motivation. I like the motivation.
I like the impulse. And, you know, and this election is such evidence of what Citizens United unleashed on us.
Oh.
I mean, not just the, like, dollars and the grotesquerie of these ads, but also that we have 14 people that stay in the race because each of them has some, you know, multimillionaire who believes in
that. Dollars,
and
right.
that's, I mean, all of this is the fallout from Citizens United. I don't know if the court reverses Citizens United in the near future. A lot of it turns on Merrick Garland. And if he gets a hearing, and if once he gets on the court, I know there's going to be a huge redoubled effort to get a campaign finance case in front of him. But this is where I think people are nervous, because it's not abundantly clear to me that this is a person who's going to reach out and overturn precedent. This is a person who is an incrementalist. He is cautious. I think his probably impulse is that Citizens United was a bad decision, but whether he's going to be sort of a brave, bold pioneer of new directions, I'm not sure.
So we're going to take a break just for a moment, and then when we come back, I've got some other questions for you about
okay.
Merrick Garland. I guess we're not going to take a break. My sound engineer, we're having the comedy of errors here this morning in the studio. So maybe this is just one of those moments, Olivia, where I say, you are listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and this is Straight Talk. And my guest today is Dahlia Lithwick, who is a courts and law writer for Slate Magazine. And we're not going anywhere. This is just where I say that.
Okay.
So now I've said it.
Let's be here.
So Dahlia, be here with me and talk to me about Merrick Garland. In particular, I'm not somebody who reads the papers. I'm guilty of getting Facebook news and, you know, the occasional NPR blurb. What I have heard about Merrick Garland is that the defense bar is not real keen on him. And being a criminal defense attorney, I have some concerns. And the reason I have those concerns
is because the reason I do criminal defense is because of Bill of Rights issues, right? I do criminal defense because I believe we have to sort of control the police state and we have to have civil liberties that must be honored. And I'm worried about Merrick Garland as a prosecutor, a career prosecutor, not caring about Fourth, Fifth, Sixth Amendment type issues. What's your read on that?
I mean, I can tell you that SCOTUS blog, which is, you know, the go-to site for wonks like me who think about the court day and night, says that he's that's a cause for worry, that this is a career prosecutor, right? He prosecuted Tim McVeigh. He prosecuted the Unabomber. This is a guy who, you know, his almost entirety of his history as a lawyer was on the prosecution side. And, you know, he talked about it when he had his little Rose Garden ceremony. He talked about that. Mm-hmm. And SCOTUS blog sort of ran the numbers and said overwhelmingly sides with the state against the defendant. And that is a cause for concern. You know, I think I would say that just, you know, to sort of like put a gloss on what you're saying, this is a court, and here we have to credit Sonia Sotomayor, also a former prosecutor, right? She has been so exquisitely attuned to racial injustice in the prosecutorial system, to the problems with the death penalty. You know, if you heard her last year on this sort of seminal death penalty case, she has been, you know, her problems with, you know, giving judges too much discretion, elected judges. She has been, I think, a clarion voice for systemically what is wrong with prosecution in this country and misconduct and how it inflects on, you know, and imbalance in funding and stuff. She has been amazing. So, you know, one thing is maybe being a prosecutor isn't the totality of it.
No,
but the other thing is I don't think he's her.
I think being a prosecutor can make you aware of these issues. And just because you have to argue one side or the other, you know, that's the position you're in, so that's the argument you make. But as a judge, I think he has been not good on these issues.
He has been not good. And I think that, you know, if you think about the ways in which some of these words like implicit bias, you know, things that are starting to creep into Supreme Court opinion writing, they're starting to understand what the rest of us see in the current, you know, imbalance in the prosecutorial system. I don't think he's that guy.
Right.
And I think that, you know, certain issues that we care about on the left, he's not going to necessarily be that guy. Would that be a basis for me to oppose his nomination? Probably not, because I think that, you know, by and large, this is a center-left guy. And I think also, and this is really important, you are different on the Supreme Court than you are, you know, and that maybe is part of the answer to Citizens United, too, is that, you know, lower court, even appeals court judges are bound by Supreme Court doctrine. Once you're on the Supreme Court, you know, in some sense, you are less bound. Merrick Garland does not strike me as somebody who's willy-nilly going to overturn Supreme Court precedent. But I do think that in a lot of ways, as I have reviewed his record, overwhelmingly, the narrative is he doesn't push.
Right.
I don't know that he's going to push on these issues, but he will have more space to push if he's on the Supreme Court.
Right. And judges, it's my understanding. Now I'm going back to law school and, you know, classes with, I think, Michael Klarman back in the day, that judges tend to drift to the left as they get older on the Supreme Court.
Absolutely. I mean, this is documented that people start on the right, except for Clarence Thomas, who likes to say, you know, I'm not evolving.
Right.
But I think
there's no dispute Clarence Thomas is not evolving.
Yes, I think he's proud of that. But I think that overwhelmingly the trend is for justices on the right to move left, and overwhelmingly the trend is not in the other direction.
Right. So perhaps, although he's not a youngster either.
He's not a youngster.
He doesn't have as many years to evolve.
He's not a youngster. And like I say, I think dispositionally he is cautious. And if you're looking at him, for instance, you know, I think about the gun issue a lot, you know, and Heller, United States versus Heller being, you know, a seminal thing that I would like the court
to D.C. gun case.
It's the D.C. gun case. And, you know, for the first time said this has nothing to do with militias. This is an individual right to defend yourself in the home. Is he going to reverse that? You know, one of the most interesting things is about the opposition to Garland is there's so little that some of the groups, and I'm thinking now of the Judicial Confirmation Network that's running ads against him. And what they're saying is he is pro-gun control. And their evidence for this is that he got Heller on the way up to the Supreme Court before there was an individual right to bear arms. Mm-hmm. And he didn't get it, actually, I should say. Mm-hmm. He wanted it to go en banc. He said, you know, this is a this the D.C. Circuit has made a decision, mm-hmm. the three-judge panel. I feel like we should look at this because there isn't
right.
a fundamental right to bear arms under mm-hmm. the Second Amendment as construed right. for decades.
Right.
And he just voted. He didn't write anything, voted right. to hear it. That is the totality of the evidence that he is for gun control. That he what he was for was stare decisis.
Right. Well, and that's something that it sounds like is his bent, is that, you know, even if he thinks something's wrongly decided, he's going to follow that stare decisis principle most of the time and go with the stability of the law and not make major changes.
Yes, you've got that face on again. That's
yeah,
sort of
that, God, that's the right thing.
Respectful despair.
Terrible. I just hate that when we do the right thing. So I want to say that you had said there was a voting rights case right now that is coming up this term. And that's of some interest here in Virginia. We've got this group called One Virginia, and there's a lot going on with redistricting issues, and it's always seemed like it was an important issue 20 years ago, and now it just seems like it's on fire. Can you talk to us a little bit about that case?
Yeah, this was kind of one of those cases that was cooked up in a think tank. I mean, this was a case that was cooked up by exactly the same person, by the way, who brought the affirmative action case, Fisher.
Mm-hmm.
So this is somebody who's thinking about this in Texas. And in effect, the claim was that the notion of that one person, one vote means that districts are drawn based on the residents of the district mm-hmm. is wrong, and it's unconstitutional because all of those people who are disenfranchised felons or who are children or who are, you know, here as legal workers mm-hmm. but are not mm-hmm. Voters, they shouldn't have a vote.
Right.
And they should not be counted for purposes of creating legislative districts.